Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we observe Holocaust Remembrance Day. In part two, we finally air a long-lost interview with the author of the book Hidden Figures, from which a major motion picture was made. Stay tuned. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and over the years that I have done this program, I count it as an exceptional privilege to have been able to speak with a wide variety of men and women who, in one way or another, were survivors of the Holocaust and telling their important stories. And the next in that long line of guests with whom I've been privileged to speak is my morning show guest today. Her name is Estelle Glazer Laughlin, and she is going to be coming to Kenosha tomorrow evening and speaking actually at the Civil War Museum beginning at 6:30 p.m., a event free and open to the public with the title Restoring Their Identity, the Fate of the Individual During the Holocaust. And during that presentation, you will be hearing about the story of Estelle Glazer Laughlin, who survived the Holocaust primarily in the so-called Warsaw Ghetto, but also in a series of concentration camps. She, her sister, and her mother were able to survive through a combination of courage and compassion, which she has also outlined in her own memoir called Transcending Darkness, A Girl's Journey Out of the Holocaust. Again, she comes to Kenosha to speak at the Civil War Museum under the auspices of the Kenosha Public Museum as part of this year's Holocaust Remembrance event. Estelle Glazer Laughlin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I feel honored to be there.
So glad that we will be able to meet you in person, but I'm glad we have this opportunity to meet you at least over the phone and find out a little bit about your life. My understanding is that you were born in Warsaw, Poland in 1929, and
yes.
You describe those early years of your childhood anyway as quite happy. Tell us more about what the, yes. Tell us more about what made the early years of your childhood so very, very happy. And maybe as you do so, also tell us something about your beloved family.
Well, my father was a businessman. He had a jewelry factory, a small one, not a large one. My mother was a housekeeper. I had a sister who was a year and a half older from me. I had family, I had friends. Warsaw glows in my selective memory in golden radiance of lilac trees against open blue skies, rich sounds of good neighbors, kindness and trust and love.
So what would be approximately the year that life began to change for you and your family and others in your community, that is, change for the worse?
I had turned 10 when Germany invaded Poland, and immediately my peaceful life changed beyond recognition. My streets were patrolled by foreign soldiers. They snapped whips in our homes and in the streets. They isolated us in a ghetto, built a thick wall around us, filled the ghetto with people driven out from surrounding areas. Most came on foot, most without a penny in their pockets, many without shoes on their feet. And people died in the streets of cold and starvation. And people covered the bodies of dead children with posters saying, children are the holiest things, children must live. Yet in this inferno, people fought heroically to hold on to their inner selves, to hold on to their values. Immediately in the ghetto in Warsaw, people organized themselves into self-aid centers to help the neediest ones. To own a book was an act of defiance punishable by death. We had theaters when we had no bread. There was a wonderful writer and historian in the ghetto, in the Warsaw ghetto. His name was Chaim Kaplan. He said that it is strange that when we don't seem to need it at all, we need poetry more than we need bread, and it is true. I think that our ability to think for ourselves, our ability to express ourselves, is our godliness. I'm pointing all of this out because people sometimes ask me, why didn't we fight back? But we fought back so hard. My mother was particularly hurt when she heard that. Not that she understood that it was not said that it was expressed innocently, that it was not an accusation, but yet she felt very indignant because she knew how hard we fought. My father, you know, to own a book I mentioned was an act of defiance, punishable with death. Yet my people all over the ghetto had secret libraries. My father had a stash of his favorite books. At nights, windows blinded with dark covers to keep our existence in secret, my father would pull out his books and read to us in our tiny room with the flickering carbide light, because we had no electricity. I remember it like a capsule of paradise. So, yes, I think that we appreciate things in absence so much more than when we have them. But we should take good things for granted like we take our thumb.
Tell us more about what daily life was like for you in those years in the Warsaw ghetto. I mean, how would you pass the time on a typical day? For instance, was it possible for you to play with your sister or with friends? And what kind of play was possible in a place like that?
Well, you know, that is the most remarkable thing about children, that children's imagination, that children remain children no matter when, no matter where. That's the beauty, that's the very basal drive to live and to be. We played when we could not be seen. In little dark rooms, in basements, in attics. You know, in one of the concentration camps in Skarżysko, where we worked in an ammunition factory. We were so famished. We looked just like ghosts, like apparitions, not like human beings. The only opening to freedom was a patch of sky. And in the factory that we were working, we were sorting bullet shells, the bad ones, sorting the imperfect ones from the perfect ones. And we devised, my sister and I, a game. As we were scooping up the shells, we would guess whether we had two of a kind or one of a kind. And so we would murmur so that we wouldn't be heard, pair or not, a pair or none, a pair of each or something like that. And then when the guard would pass, my mother would clear her throat, go, and we were working at the same time, so it wasn't as though we weren't working, but we didn't even have the freedom to do that. But the wonderful thing about children is their imagination, so we played wherever we could. In the ghetto, my family was not starving because my father was a jeweler. Jewelry during the war becomes the most stable currency. So, and interestingly, there was a black market in the ghetto. There were the German guards and the Polish guards. Now, you have to imagine the ghetto completely enclosed by a thick wall. And there were gates, a number of gates, and they were guarded by Polish Jewish policemen too, and Nazis, and of course there was that wall. Do you know? So there was a lot of smuggling. Many German guards and Polish guards and Jewish guards lined their pockets with bribery. So this was the bigger. At some point, if a cart load with food or whatever would be coming through, they would open the gate and just not look at it. But you know who the most essential smugglers were? Little kids, no older than 7 or 8 years old. They were the little smugglers, and they would crawl under the wall, climb over the wall was covered with barbed wire and also glass shards, very sharp glass shards. They would step on each other's shoulders, throw a coat over the shards and the barbed wire, and hop down. Of course, you heard constantly shooting, and you saw the blood, their blood on the wall. But when they made it, their family was eating that night. So it's the drive to live, the drive to be is a wonderful thing. People sometimes ask me, did I have hope? I don't think we had hope when we were in Majdanek extermination camp in front of the gas chamber. We knew that we were stored until there was room in the gas chamber. But I remember that I wanted to live. I felt that current, that drive, that basic drive to live. And my mother would say to us, darlings, life is precious. It is noble to fight to stay alive. I'm sorry, I got carried away.
It's an important story you're sharing, and I'm so glad we can hear it. Let me reintroduce you. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Estelle Glazer-Laughlin. She is a Holocaust survivor. She experienced some of the Holocaust in the so-called Warsaw Ghetto, and she and her mother and sister were also sent off to a series of concentration camps. Fortunately, they were able to survive. And Estelle Laughlin is coming to Kenosha to speak at the Holocaust Remembrance Day event there tomorrow night. Today, of course, is Holocaust Remembrance Day. Estelle Laughlin, I'm not sure we have yet touched on, at least in any detail, on the background of your mother, whose own story was really quite interesting. And yes. And in some ways, what she experienced and the combination of her personality was probably one of the reasons why she was able to withstand what she did and to help you and your sister survive as she did. Tell our listeners about where she came from and what she experienced and how you think that helped equip her to surmount the horrors of the Holocaust as well as she did.
I hope I can do it justice in these few minutes. I probably can't. And more of the description of my mother's courage and is in my book. My mother, you know, Jews were persecuted throughout the ages. My mother, in many ways, experienced persecution twice. My mother was born in a small shtetl in Vitebsk, White, Belarus. And at some point, like in the story of the fiddler of on the roof, she was chased out from her shtetl. And the remarkable thing about my mother was that she loved beauty. When we were little children, she would sing to us and describe to us the beautiful meadows in Belarus, covered with forget-me-nots, and how she heard the voices of the peasants working in the fields. And what also amazed me was that my mother, while she was indignant about the suffering that they imposed on her, she also was able to say to us, the Russian people were very suffering people and very feeling people. And so I think it is true that suffering does not have to drive you to anger and despair. It can teach you to love more deeply and to be more compassionate and also to be feisty. My mother was very feisty, and I inherited her feistiness.
And I'm sure that was one reason why she survived and you survived, although it, of course, took much more than that in order to endure what you ultimately endured. How long were you sequestered in the so-called Warsaw Ghetto before your mother and sister and you were sent off to the first of several concentration camps? At what point did that occur, and why? Under what circumstances did that occur?
The why was just a crazy commitment of a civilized people. This is why I share my stories. I think this is why people want to know, to be reminded that human beings are capable of great evil, and in recognizing it and listening to it and being aware of it, hopefully recognize the importance of love and unity, that we are like humanity is like a symphony a symphony with a piccolo only is not as rich as a full symphony, and I think that's part of humanity, and that's the part of the United States that I love so much, is that it's made up of so many minorities, like a beautiful orchestra. I think I lost track of your question.
I was just I like all that you're saying.
What were the circumstances that took me to the concentration camp?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the reason at some point Himmler decided to liquidate the ghetto and took all the people to Treblinka. Between July 1942, I was at that, it was the month of my 13th birthday, and September 1942, 99% of the children in the ghetto disappeared. Can you imagine a world without the sound of children, without the presence of grandmothers and grandfathers, because old people and children were first to be liquidated? Well, the deportations took place with 20th century know-how and Stone Age values. They liquidated the ghetto, practically liquidated the ghetto in the 2 months. We never heard from the people. We had no idea at first that deportations meant death. Some people were forced to write false letters inviting families where they were fed and clad and sheltered. So some people did. Many people hid. My family hid behind a wardrobe that covered a door. But we never heard from the people. But some people managed to come under the cover of night, return back to Warsaw, a handful, and they told us about these horrendous train rides to Treblinka, where our people were guests. At that point, when that became apparent, when we heard about Treblinka, the people in the ghetto, it was only a very small group of people left. There was such silence. I remember trying to stick my head out of the gate of our building to hear the sound of life. Silence was palpable, was crawling towards me. But at that point, the people organized themselves into armed resistance. My father was a member of the underground too, and the underground, the fighters, build bunkers in basements, and so we had a bunker too, and the events erupted with Nazi columns entering the ghetto with armored cars, with tanks, with bomber planes, and we lifted the secret trapdoor, which was our commode, powder room floor and commode, all lifted and pulled the trapdoor down, and the ceiling pressed down on me, the damp door walls closed in on me. The flickering of the carbide light was our substitute for the sun. The only contact with the outside world was the ticking of the clock that gave us a clue when morning was rising and night was setting. How I missed the open horizon, the blue crispness of day. Some point a bomb was dropped into the bunker, and they dragged us out, and they dragged us through the streets. We did not walk like a swarm of nameless people, were people with names and love and dreams like everyone else. We too wanted to take the people we loved for granted. We too wanted to take the feeling of touching grass for granted. And they marched us to Umschlagplatz to build bomber flocks of bomber planes dropping incendiary bombs. Flames, enormous tongues of flames, licked the sky and painted it in other colors of iridescent smoke. People in congealed blood, and they marched us to Umschlagplatz, loaded us onto trains, and took us to Majdanek extermination camp, where the electrified barbed wire fence marked the end of my horizon. My father was guest in Majdanek. My mother's sister and I survived. I want you to know we survived with love for humanity, with compassion and joy for life. Life should be lived joyfully. Liberation was not at all like what one is likely to imagine. My book, by the way, at least I would say one third of it, is about liberation, because very little has been written about it. We were liberated by the Russian forces, by the Red Army. Very little has been written, but we wandered through Poland, through Czechoslovakia, into Germany, where we had to come to terms to face the people. That how would did I know who shoved my father into the gas chamber, and who was innocent, and how we I it took a while to learn to get let go of anger and recognize the importance of hate cannot go on forever. The importance of love, and my mother, in front of the crematorium, my poetic mother, who was not able to adjust to life, to start life over again. Not every survivor was able to start life over again. Said to us, in front of the crematoria, you'll see. If we survive, you'll see that the Nazis' children and Nazis' children and their children's children for generations will be asking, where were you? Where was the conscience? And you know what? We thought she was out of her mind, but she's right. She was right. Now people in Germany are asking, how could it have happened? And I am ever so grateful for it, because understanding is essential if civilization is to progress. And I feel that we are all left with the legacy to understand what human beings and nobility we are capable of, and the cruelty, and to remember it, that. And this is why it's hard to speak about it, but this is why I speak about it, because I want my grandchildren and all the grandchildren in the world to inherit a better life than my generation experienced. Mm-hmm.
Tell us, Estelle Laughlin, at what point you made your way to America.
Eventually we came in 1947. There were quotas, and we waited for our quota. We got There is a wonderful Jewish organization, Hayas. By the way, they are helping not only Jewish people, they help anyone who has been persecuted and is searching for a way to freedom. And so they are non-denominational in terms of being of assistance. I don't remember whether they gave each one of my mother, sister, and me $10 each or $10 together, but they made it possible for us to come to the United States. My mother had a brother and two sisters here. I mentioned before that my mother had a hard time. My poetic, wonderful mother had a hard time starting life over again. My sister and I were young. I was, I believe, probably 18 or just turned 18. My sister was a year and a half older. So we started out working in New York in the garment district in a garment factory, sewing buttons. And eventually we entered college. I had only 3 years of elementary school education, and then some tutoring in the ghetto. My sister had maybe 4 or 5. So we entered, we took college entrance exams at some point, a few years after we came here, maybe 3, 4 years, something like that. And she became a professor of comparative literature. I became a teacher. I am mentioning this for two reasons, because I think I'm an average person, and I want everyone to know that average people are capable of a great deal. But more than that, I am mentioning that because our motivation and inspiration to be the best we could be, to explore life, all the tastes of life we could, came from the darkest place. You know, I described to you the uprising. I described to you the bunker when the world was crumbling around us. My father had a tutor for us. And so that's where the inspiration came. And I didn't mention that while we were hiding in the bunker, fighting broke out in the streets, facing a 20th century army, armed from head to toe, facing armored cars, facing tanks and flocks of planes, stood a handful of poorly clad, poorly fed, poorly armed freedom fighters. They climbed up on rooftops. They climbed out. I didn't describe to you, and it's in my book, the passages that they dug under the in the netherworld, that took them crisscross the ghetto and onto the Aryan side too, in order to get arms from the Christian and underground on the other side of the wall. And what is they climbed up on rooftops. They were lobbing Molotov cocktails, whatever they had. What is so remarkable is that it took that band of freedom fighters longer to fight than it took for France and for Poland to capitulate.
Hmm. Wow.
Yes.
Tell us what you have shared about your own experience with your own children and your grandchildren. And has this been a difficult story to share with them?
It was a very difficult story to share. I was very fearful I didn't want any shadows of my pains color their trust in humanity, because I do trust humanity. I do believe that there is goodness in everyone, even when people do evil, that I like to address. I told you that my mother was feisty, and I am feisty. So I was very fearful not to pass on to them the mistrust in humanity, and ability to love humanity. So at first, it was very difficult. Also, at the very beginning, it was difficult to talk about it, and it was also very difficult for people to listen. Both sides were awkward. People would ask questions like, "Why didn't you fight back?" Or they would say, "Well, we too suffered during the war. We had no nylons and no chocolate." And of course, when you hear that, you stop talking. I never believed that it was said out of thoughtlessness, probably more out of awkwardness. I know I'm sometimes awkward when I hear someone share with me something very painful, and I will, instead of just listening, I will say something that I later regret. So it took it. I think now people are more informed. I think the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and the Skokie Museum here in Chicago are doing a wonderful job in educating people about human suffering and about the importance of human dignity, which really is the beauty of the United States, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, acknowledges the importance of the human dignity.
We are so grateful that you can come to Kenosha to share your story in more detail. Again, your talk will begin at 6:30 p.m., and you will be at Kenosha Civil War Museum for their Holocaust Remembrance Day event. Estelle Glazer Laughlin, and your memoir is called Transcending Darkness, A Girl's Journey Out of the Holocaust. And certainly from all you've shared with us today, we can see how your life has been exactly that, an inspiring case of emerging from darkness into a life that has turned out to be quite beautiful and also of great inspiration. And Estelle Laughlin, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and wish you the very best with all that stretches ahead for you.
And I thank you, and I thank everyone who takes interest in the common suffering of human beings, and for wanting to make the world a wonderful place for everyone.
It's 11 minutes before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. For part two of our program, a long-lost interview, and I'm not sure this interview has actually ever even aired, but just earlier this morning, I finally came across my interview concerning the superb book and eventually the superb motion picture called Hidden Figures. Here is that conversation. I suspect that some of you have heard at least a little bit about a remarkable book, soon to be a remarkable motion picture as well, based on a story at NASA of some black women in an era when such things were quite uncommon, all but impossible, in fact, were mathematicians behind the walls of NASA and making a very, very significant difference at NASA during some crucial years in America's development of its aeronautics industry. The book at hand is Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. The author is Margot Lee Shetterly, and she is an Alfred P. Sloan Foundation fellow who has also done extensive research on the place of women in computing. And she happens to have grown up in Hampton, Virginia, which is the location of the Langley Aeronautical Library where these women did their important work. Margot Lee Shetterly, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, and good morning to everyone.
I'm excited to be talking with you about this remarkable story. I think I am, like most Americans, knowing nothing about this story until the emergence of your book. You knew something of their story, of course, because you had the pleasure of knowing some of these women there in Hampton, Virginia. Tell us first where your personal connection began with them and how you came to know their story.
Right. Well, my personal connection really began with my family. My father is a retired research scientist. He worked his entire career at the NASA Langley Research Center. He started working there in 1966, so really, you know, during the height of the civil rights movement, during the height of the space race. And but here in Hampton, Virginia, there was a community of people of all backgrounds who were engineers, who were scientists, who were mathematicians. Many of them were women, and many of that group of women were African-American, among those the women that I write about in my book. So I was very fortunate to grow up in a place where I got to see African-Americans and women of all backgrounds working and succeeding in the science field and not think of that as something particularly unusual.
Mm. What really was the catalyst for these particular women becoming part of NASA was actually something which occurred over wide fronts during the Second World War, where so many men were called to the field of battle or called to be part of the military, even as scientists and in other roles, leaving gaping voids that in some cases had to be filled. And so this goes beyond the iconic figure of Rosie the Riveter. These are women stepping into voids that were essentially left in our aeronautics industry. Tell us about the transaction which allowed this to take place and what these women were doing at the time that this, in a sense, summons came from NASA.
Right. Well, women have always been interested in math. I think there's a misperception about women and their mathematical abilities. But women who were good at math and who had studied math usually became math teachers. They put their degrees to use in the classroom. And then during World War II, just as you said, there was a tremendous demand for labor. There was a tremendous demand for aeronautical research. You know, planes had become this important agent of victory for the war. Like, this was changing the course of World War II. And so there in Hampton, they needed all hands on deck. They needed all of the mathematical computing power to do that research, to make the planes safer, make them fly faster, make them go longer distance without needing fuel. And what they needed were computers at a time when a computer was a person who was simply a job title, usually a woman in those days, who computed. So I think it's hard for us sometimes to remember just how transformative World War II was and how many things that we take for granted today happened during World War II. But one of them was that women were able to step into jobs that were previously allocated only to men, and get a foot in the door and prove themselves. So this was certainly true of the entire group of women, and it had particular resonance for the African-American women who faced barriers not just because of their gender but also because of their race.
Right. And, of course, one thing that is maybe a bit uncommon about this particular story is that in so many cases, women who were given these exciting new opportunities during the Second World War found themselves shoved aside. Not in every case, but in many, many cases, shoved aside once the war was over and life returned to some semblance of normalcy. But in this case, these women were doing great work at NASA and were allowed to continue that over the course of decades.
That is very true. And, you know, it's true that there were some cutbacks. You know, I look back at the records and the employee newsletters, and they talk about the cutbacks, and, you know, the war is over, and we're going to have to reduce our force. You know, but in the end of the day, even as World War II trailed off, there continued to be this demand for aviation. You know, planes, we take planes for granted. We go to the airport, we get on the plane, we don't even think about it. But, you know, planes really transformed in so many ways our modern life. And so, you know, as the continued demand for faster planes, for military planes, for supersonic aircraft, all of that continued through the late 40s, throughout the 50s, the Cold War, and then the space race. And all of those things require mathematical support. You know, you can think of these, think of all the things that we do with our computers today, all the analysis, all of the computing. We rely on them so heavily. Well, these women provided that kind of support to that highly analytical work that was being done there at Langley and at other NASA centers across the country.
As we mentioned, Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory is located in Hampton, Virginia. Virginia would have been a Jim Crow state with Jim Crow practices in place, Jim Crow laws in many cases in place. And one of the most poignant things about your book is the discussion of what that was like to for these women to be working in a place like NASA, couched in a community where black and white were very much separated. And talk for a moment about that particular facet of this story and how important it was to tell that thoroughly.
Yeah, so the thing about it is they were, as African-American women, they lived in a worked in a separate workroom. They had separate bathrooms. They had a separate cafeteria. You know, all of those things applied to them within the center, even though they had this new job that previously hadn't been open to them before. You know, it's a painful part of the history, you know, but it is a part of history. So we have to look at the thrilling parts along with the really painful and difficult parts. And they were truly patriotic, you know, despite that Jim Crow segregation. They never stopped working on behalf of the United States government on the mission for NASA, for, you know, getting American soldiers and pilots into planes that were safe, and eventually sending astronauts into space and landing them on the moon and bringing them home safely.
And one of the most moving aspects of this whole story is the fact that these women have not seemed to be all that interested in accolades. In fact, I'm curious to what extent they were receptive to the idea of their story being told in this way.
Well, you know, you ask them over and over again, what do you think about this this sort of new light that's being shined on you and the work? And they, almost to a person, they say, you know what, I love my work, but at the end of the day, I was just doing my job.
Mm-hmm. The book, again, is Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. And the book is by Margot Lee Shetterly, soon to be a major motion picture. Margot Lee Shetterly, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book and joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be previewing for you the upcoming performances at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside of the German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. I'll be joined by by two faculty members from the music faculty of Parkside to talk about that work. We'll also preview two upcoming musicals being performed in the area. The Mystery of Edwin Drood at Carthage and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum at Parkside. That will be on Wednesday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.